So it's probably overstating it to call it a law. It's more of an observation or an economic theory. And the observation that Gordon Moore made was that they would be able to cram twice as many transistors on a chip every 2 years or so.
Welcome to Sciencetown, a podcast about the most unique research community on the planet. With every episode, we will bring you cutting-edge tech, science, and startup culture through the eyes of pioneering men and women. Their journeys cross disciplines and cross borders in the pursuit of world-changing science.
Hello, my name is Nicholas DeMille.
And I'm Ben Stevens.
Supercomputing, extreme computing, high-performance computing. Regardless of what you choose to call it, it underpins much of the cutting-edge scientific research being done today. In this bonus episode, we follow experts from around the world to the epicenter of supercomputing, the annual North American Supercomputing Conference, or SC19. We ask them how the future of computers, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and much else are coming together to shape the way we explore and understand our world.
He thought it would last for maybe 15 years or so because it's an exponential, but it ended up lasting for 50 years. So every 18 months to 24 months, we would be able to double the number of transistors you could put on a chip. And also, each of those transistors would be proportionally more energy efficient, so it would also improve the clock rate and it would improve the energy efficiency each generation.
That's John Schaff, Department Head for Computer Science in the Computing Research Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
In 2004, the Dennard scaling, which was our ability to reduce voltages and therefore have exponentially increasing clock frequencies, that ended in 2004. So the only way we could extract more performance is to go with extreme parallelism, and that led to the exascale programs in many countries, you know, multi-billion dollar investments to redesign the machines and our software and our applications to overcome that. But the second shoe is about to drop, and that's that we can't even cram more transistors onto the chip because we're getting down to atomic scale, and also the value for continuing to shrink transistors, it isn't delivering performance improvements for the end applications. So that means we need to look at a new approach to getting performance out of future computer chips. In the near term, the only game in town is architecture specialization. And if you look at like the Google TPU, if the algorithm that they had implemented with this specialized AI processor was what we needed for exascale, then we could have done an exaflop machine in 2015 with just 3 megawatts of power. Unfortunately, it doesn't do what we need for science. And the question is, how can we learn from the kinds of specialization that we need to do to make science successful and continue to scale into the future?
You mentioned a bit about AI and machine learning, and there are lots of people talking about this. I think there are fewer people talking about how you train the next generation of people and what that means for recruiting talent and things, because I think particularly in your area of the world, that's exceptionally hard. So Talk a little bit about that.
Well, actually, talent recruitment in AI and machine learning is especially difficult because we have Google right there in South Bay. And I am a little bit concerned that we're trying to out-Google Google. It so happens, though, that the lab environment is a very open research environment. It allows people to pursue interesting and scientifically impactful directions, whereas working for a company, you have to toe the line in order to do things that make money for and follow the product direction. So I do find that people who are interested in what the lab has to offer are willing to take the less pay in exchange for research and academic freedom. And that's always kind of the tension. There's no way we're going to outcompete Google on paychecks, but we can outcompete them on interesting things to do.
We'll be right back.
What is that crystal ball that you look into to say researchers in 5 and 10 years are going to need X? How do you do that?
How do we do technology forecasting? I mean, I spend a lot of time in a meeting like this finding out what people, especially in other countries, are doing, because you end up kind of confined to your groupthink from the people that you have regular contact with. Coming to a meeting like this, I get to ask people who are thinking completely differently about technology roadmaps. And, in DOE, we are fairly mission-oriented. DOE, the side of DOE I'm in is the Office of Science, which does all of the basic sciences, splitting atoms, material science, genomics. And so I always start with what are the big scientific challenges that need computing in the future?
I feel like I've heard a number of people say, and I think that's where you're headed with this, that storage of this data is perhaps the biggest bottleneck. Am I getting that correct?
Not storage. It's generating data, but 90% of the data is noise. And so if we could integrate processing inside of the sensor where the data is produced, we could get rid of 90% of the data. This is also the case for the HEP detectors for CERN. There's a lot of events that contain no interesting or scientifically useful information, but it takes a lot of computing horsepower integrated right next to the sensor to get that out of the way. So, but it is also the case that our data storage technologies are based on a concept that dates back to tape in the 1950s. If you just look at the way that you do read, write, open, close, it looks like the little buttons on your old reel-to-reel tape deck, because that's actually what the entire I/O was based on, was tape decks. But if you look at today's storage technology, it looks nothing like tape at all. In fact, it looks more like memory than ever before. And yet our storage technology has not evolved to treat storage in a modern way, that it's really just another form of memory. And that's a big opportunity for change in the software environment. Revise our entire concept of file systems and create an environment that is aligned with the technology and also more useful for the researchers.
John Schaff, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks.
We've seen that convergence between ML, AI, and the HPC world in the past few years, actually. And for us HPC people, we see it basically as another application.
That's Sabir Feki, a computational scientist team lead in the KAUST Supercomputing Core Lab.
We have been working with computational sciences and engineering in different areas for the HPC. And ML and AI now is the newcomer, and it seems that the HPC platform is very suitable to these kind of applications. The community of AI and machine learning is not acquainted to the HPC environment in terms of hardware and software. So it's coming out from different background in terms of programming models and so on and so forth. And now they are started learning about HPC because the interest coming basically from the fact that HPC platform is very suitable for them to be very efficient and do their work more effectively.
So do I understand it right then that in a way AI or machine learning or any other application that falls into that space is in a way just a specific problem for you guys to solve with high performance computing?
That's correct, yeah. That's the way we see it. And even though they might be solving different problems that are not always solved in HPC systems,
right,
but these people are now coming to us to help them. They've been working on the cloud, and now they're coming to HPC. And even the cloud is becoming HPC, and all this dynamic is happening. The other new thing that is, it started happening, it's going to happen even more in the future, is the merger between AI and HPC together to solve new challenging problems.
With machine learning, for instance, is it a more flexible application in a way? So it's adapting to data rather than simply using it?
So in HPC, we have an initial condition, and then we look at the environment and how it evolves and find out and predict the end result. One example is a fluid throw of airplane, and then you have an initial condition, and then over time you can see how that evolves. On machine learning, it's the other way around, where you don't generate data but digest data. And instead of creating the model mathematically based on the physics, you fit the data, massive amount of data typically, you fit that data to a model. It's a data model, and make that black box predict what's coming next on different scenario.
Stones are out there to be broken.
At the exascale era, okay, we probably can compute 10 to the power of 18 floating point operation per second. That's fantastic. And we will solve very interesting problems. What we still lack is the data ingestion capabilities of these systems.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly the top 500 list skew the design of this system toward more the compute part, right? So there's a big focus on calculating more and more within the second. But what we miss, and we keep asking chip manufacturers and the industry to do, is to increase significantly the memory bandwidth, which is a specificity of the system that makes it capable of ingesting data in much bigger rate.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be very important in the next era, where smartphones are everywhere, sensors everywhere, and lots of data will be available for people to explore. And you will not be able to find out insights or create new models that will help humanity in general without adding this capability of faster ingestion of data.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing the storage performance, increasing the memory bandwidth, and all these things glued together with an exascale system, that is needed, and we hope to see that happening in the future.
So do we still have a data problem, in so much as we have so much data that we can't process it or bring it on
absolutely.
Board.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you see at most of the big data talks, the term that always happen is dark data. We have, in the future, we'll have zettabytes of data. That's thousands of petabytes. And most of it will be dark.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way on earth that we have the capability to get insight of this data and look at it carefully and mm-hmm. find something interesting.
You know, we often talk about how it's not just plug a computer in and you have a resource, but it's largely about the people. So what's the people impact, if there is any, of AI and machine learning kind of coming into this space?
Absolutely. When we talk to people in the industry, they say about two things. So machine learning and AI are hungry for the two type of resources, the compute resources and people resources, because these kind of modeling with mm-hmm. for AI requires a lot of trial and error kind of things.
Oh.
What we call technically a hyperparameter search,
mm-hmm.
where we look at all multiple combinations of parameters until you get the most fitting model to your data.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires also significant human power. So we will see that increase in researchers. So we need more faculty, more researchers doing all this work with the end users, with the data holders. Mm-hmm. And then we need the domain expertise, right? Because AI is typically applied to some domain science, right? Whether it is the Red Sea models or the fishes in the Red Sea, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
So why do people in general come to this conference? Why is this important, as a professional touchstone for many people?
Well, ASC is a very large event. No? We have this year almost 14,000 people here.
That's Rosa Badia. She's a group manager at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center.
And there is people from very different places and from very different profiles, no? So it's a very good opportunity to meet a lot of people, no? And to present the new work, to catch up with ongoing projects, to do some volunteer work in the organization. So, and to have fun also, I'll say, no? So it's really an incredible place to, even it's a black box, I think here some of us feel inside the community, and it's a very nice event.
Yeah. What do you think the future of HPC is going to be in general? What big picture things are coming?
I think the future is very promising. No? We have a lot of applications that need supercomputing, and applications that people don't realize that need supercomputing. And I think this is the secret, no? It's like, who would think that we will have smartphones, no? Some years ago. So I think this is what will happen, no? That HPC will open a box for new opportunities to do many things that we don't imagine now. So from things like better medicine, better exploration of any aspect, no, from climate, from science, geophysics, whatever. Okay, so I think, although of course there are also data centers and clouds, but HPC still has a big roadmap ahead to do a lot of challenges.
How do you see the movement of AI and machine learning into this HPC space? And how does that affect the work that you do back in Barcelona?
Well, it's interesting, no? Because in one side we think, well, it's a new buzzword, a new keyword, but and everybody is jumping into it, and everybody now talks as if it's an expert. Of course, I'm not an expert, no? But I try to use these technologies and combine them with our environment. No? Then it's very interesting because it enables the domain experts to have new tools that make their applications much more powerful. No? So this is one aspect, and that's why we try to combine them from our programming model. The other is that we can also use these tools inside our tools, no? As driving our runtime, making better decisions using machine learning or using deep learning. Okay? Deep learning probably is difficult because it requires a lot of data to do the training, but there are a lot of tools for machine learning that can be used for scheduling, for placement, for making decisions. So I think what now is seen as a novelty, in a few years will be the way of doing this, and we will find this normal, no? To use this type of tools in the both in the system tools and in the applications.
What things seem nearly impossible now, but you think may be commonplace in 5 to 10 years? What, you know, what leaps do you envision?
Well, I envision that scientists should be able to do very complex applications that combine simulations, traditional modeling and MPI simulations with machine learning in a way that they can build intelligent applications. No? The fact that the same application should be able to decide the next steps to explore. Okay, right now we do more deterministic workflows or deterministic applications. In the future, I think that we will be able to build these intelligent applications that will help to advancing in science, to getting knowledge much more faster than we can today.
How do organizations like yours, universities, industry, etc., how do they include more female voices in decision making and bring, you know, a larger portion of this new generation of students into the fold?
Well, I think that there are two different issues. One is if students or girls want to follow the studies, and you cannot force them to follow studies if they don't want. No? So what I think we should ensure is that any girl that wants to follow IT is never disencouraged to do it. Okay, this is one thing. The other thing is when they are already in, that some people say, well, it's more easy for them to left their work and do another, stay at home, or sometimes that they don't scale positions as easier as men. Probably this is something that in the near future will improve. I think it's a matter of time. My mother wanted to study at the university and her father didn't allow her, okay? And just after a generation, nobody will do this, no?
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you to you, Nick.
Hatem El Tayef. I'm a senior research scientist. I think, you know, the people on both sides, AI/ML and HPC, have been sitting on their own world. And we're really seeing moving forward a convergence which sounds more like a consent marriage, where those two notions should really get together to be able to help out scientists in doing their simulation. And both notions have their own specification. And I think it's really time for the people from both sides to sit together and find out common ground, because it really turns out that those notions are really intertwined in the sense that AI will be used moving forward to leverage HPC workload.
Yeah.
And HPC will be used to leverage AI workload. So this is, I guess, a common theme right now in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And and I can speak about it from my own perspective.
Please,
in
yeah.
linear algebra, for instance,
yeah.
where, you know, linear algebra, so I'm developing numerical linear algebra algorithm for massively parallel systems. And so linear algebra is a common denominator for a broad set of application, right? And so basically, if you are able to speed up a given numerical algorithm, chances are you'll have out there 2, 3, 4 application that can benefit from it right away. Looking at AI workload and HPC workload from a linear algebra algorithm developer, I can see that indeed even AI workload can be speed up using those numerical algorithms. So, the good thing about it is, you know, you could have situations where one stone, multiple birds. So we used to sort of support and service HPC application. And for us, you know, AI workload are not that much different from HPC workload.
Right.
So because again, of those common denominator between those two fields. Yeah. Actually, 150 years ago, one famous Russian scientist came up with a nice algorithm at that time doing the singular value decomposition, which is one of the workhorse linear algebra kernel. And at a time when he came up with that new algorithm, you know, really people laughed at him in the sense that he was actually performing like 10 or 20 times more operation than the standard, you know, singular value decomposition algorithm available at that time. And people really laughed at him. And, you know, when he seen this, he, I guess probably he got frustrated and opened the drawer, put the algorithm there, just, you know, close the drawer and forget about it. What happened is only... I believe 7 years ago. So people, you know, he documented, of course, that work. So people revived his algorithm. Why did they revive his algorithm? Because we had huge computational power today. Okay. So of course, at that time, there were no digital computer available. But this 10x slower or more operation algorithm compared to the reference one could perhaps be now a game change for on those current you know system. And what we've seen, so we looked at that algorithm, we tried to port it on existing you know supercomputers and accelerators, and we were able now to actually be 10 times faster than the regular algorithm, right? So indeed it took 150 years really to revive such algorithm, but you needed to have the proper hardware and the proper algorithm available to get you know performance out of this algorithm, which you know has so many operation extra operation that the regular one do not have.
I'm sure you do in the HPC community, but I don't think a lot of people outside of that world appreciate that there's math that was written that long ago that's running on these computers. Do you guys often have a sense of history like that, or is that kind of an outlier?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you give a talk, actually, I remember the first time when I gave a talk about this topic, I have one slide showing, you know, how the algorithm, you know, changed and how, you know, looking at the hardware evolution at the same time. And looking at the mismatch, right? I mean, this algorithm does lots of operation, but it does nice operation in the sense that these operation can be computed in parallel, right? In, as we say, embarrassingly parallel. And therefore, when you put it, when you throw at a computer which has so many resources available, which a few decades ago we did not have, then all of a sudden, that algorithm can really leverage performance on those massively parallel systems. So yeah, I do have a slide on this, and this is always a funny story to tell, but that is true. I mean, I think a lot of things have been looked at, you know, in history, I mean, in previous decades, and some of them have been completely overlooked. And I think it's probably time to go back to them and revisit this idea and see how, you know, today's supercomputer could run them efficiently.
What opportunities do you foresee for early and mid-career scientists that these changes in HPC might bring about?
Yeah, so, you know, I heard one of our collaborators saying earlier that, you know, he had a daughter which graduated in computer science just this year.
Yeah.
And she never wrote a single line of Fortran programming language. She only knows Python, right? So this was, you know, a nice quote from him. And yeah, I mean, you know, scientists, the junior scientists really, you know, I think they, you know, it's very exciting for them what is coming, what is upcoming. And AI and HPC are really, you know, a theme which are multidisciplinary or cross-cutting themes, and you know these junior scientists can really be able to work with you know domain scientists from various backgrounds, and I think this is really what is cool about it, that you know today you could work with chemists, tomorrow you could work with astronomers, and really being able to see the impact that you can bring to those domain scientists, I think this is really cool.
Speaking of those domain scientists, so what opportunities do you foresee for them in the next 5 or 10 years in terms of things that we thought were kind of a big idea we'd love to be able to, but we can't, but now it's going to be possible?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's really cool to be in HPC these days. And indeed, what are the some of the things that they will be able to do? I mean, not only, being able to compute faster or get the solution faster, but they would be able to get better out of their computation and simulation, meaning, higher resolution, for instance, simulation for climate and weather application, solving extremely large problem, looking at things that before were not tractable, and I think this is really exciting for them too.
Excellent. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'm Michael Haru. I work at Sandia National Labs. I'm a senior scientist there. I'm also the director of software technology for the U.S. Department of Energy Exascale Computing Project.
What is the next 5 or 10 years look for the HPC side of things as they continue to deal with AI and ML of demand?
Yeah. So within the U.S., there have been a series of workshops for the Department of Energy called AI for Science. Where we've tried to explore and get people who are thinking a little further ahead than others, what are the opportunities for integrating AI or even substituting AI capabilities for more traditional approaches of using that we've done with modeling and simulation. So we're trying to understand, okay, if we want to understand the scientific questions or the challenges that face us, this is a holistic view of how can we do that, integrating the best of modeling and simulation with the best of machine learning techniques.
What does that mean for the people in this space, training the talent, even getting the talent? I know because of AI and ML, there is a big challenge. So talk a little
bit. Yeah, there's a big challenge in a variety of ways. These platforms are the way forward for many computational communities. GPUs, for example, are, the NVIDIA processors are really good at AI, deep neural networks, and these techniques are being, and then you have that in coming at the same time as large data sets are coming on available, because of internet and large repositories of information that are available, where we can really take and make huge advances and insights into things, even outside of traditional what we call modeling and simulation, which has been the core part of high performance computing for many years. So there's a growing market. There's a growing need for people in this area. The talent pool can only grow so quickly. So it's very challenging, but also just extremely exciting. Really fun to be a part of it. So universities are essential. That's where a lot of the fundamental research occurs. I tend to think of it as you have universities, you have research laboratories that are like the DOE laboratories or other international laboratories, and then you have the vendors. And kind of in that order is the time scope and the depth at which they can start to explore ideas. And so universities are where some of the latest and high-risk, high-reward work gets done. So we need them to participate in this, very much so, yeah.
User community for many of these resources is quite interesting. Do you have any examples that you'd like to share about the research that's being the outcome of being able to use some of these resources?
So within the climate science community, for example, there are a lot of new efforts where we're trying to make use of these very large machines. We're also looking at alternatives to more traditional mathematical modeling approaches in some areas. For example, we have a lot of data that come in from sensors and just meteorological data, which we can then use in raw form to create what are called model-free inference engines, to predict how, say, for example, clouds could behave, which are a difficult thing to predict using more traditional approaches. And so these are some of the things that I foresee. Being able to qualitatively improve both our effectiveness and efficiency in getting insight into some of the really challenging issues that we face as a nation and a world.
I've had a number of people also say that they don't completely understand, it's not always completely understood, why some of these algorithms work. What is that about?
Yeah, well, that's sometimes called the explainability, right? So you create this inference engine, which is this thing that will predict what's going to happen. And you use it by giving it training data, and then you reserve some of your data to test it to see, the answer. Did the inference engine get the same answer as what the test data would have said it should get? Right, and so you try to balance that, but at least at this point, we don't understand exactly why it got the answer it got. Nor can we, with full confidence, say that if we give it new data that it's never seen before, that the answer that the inference engine gives us is the answer that is a reasonable answer. Right, so it's a challenging issue, and there are a lot of people working on, adding explainability to what's coming out of these AI approaches. So it's not an unsolvable problem. It's just that we've moved along so rapidly in our capabilities with this hammer. It's a new hammer for us that we haven't had a chance to fully understand and characterize when it gives good answers and when it might not give good answers.
I'm always asking, what's the crystal ball that you look into to understand how to develop the computing resources that researchers will need 5 and 10 years from now?
Right. Yeah. So in my area, I lead I'm the director of the software technology area for the U.S. Exascale project, and our task is to create the software stack of reusable software components that applications use. These are things like the message passing libraries that all applications use transferring data between nodes on a big parallel computer, some of the compiler technology, some of the math scientific libraries, the data and viz tools. So I lead that portfolio for the U.S. Exascale project. And one of the things that we're seeing is that we need to invest in high-quality, coordinated software activities so that we can have a sustainable scientific software stack. And so a big emphasis within the U.S. in the Exascale project is to not only create new capabilities, but do so in a way that's coordinated. And I think it's going to be even more important as we start to integrate AI capabilities into what we're doing, because industry provides a lot of AI software. Lots of people use TensorFlow, PyTorch, Keras. These are all well-known tools, right? But there, as we get deeper into knowing what we need in terms of AI capabilities, we're going to need to enhance those, expand, maybe even substitute some of those industry approaches with some of our own approaches that are really adept at doing scientific problems. And so we're going to need to create high-quality software and be able to distribute it out to people. And so a lot of the technology we're working on within the U.S. Exascale project is to make the development and delivery of software to vendors, to the facilities, to our user base as easy as possible. And it's actually working really well. We've had a number of meetings here at the supercomputing conference where users who wanted to use existing scientific software and say integrate a library into their application code, they would have to go and individually grab each one of these libraries and build it and test it, look at its interface and try to use it. But now because we're coordinating this activity, and we're introducing container technologies, which allow you, you know, portable binary execution on many different platforms. We're really lowering the barrier to use of these software capabilities and improving the overall software ecosystem for everybody. And I think that that's actually one of the things that is changing and people are recognizing need to change with high-performance computing. It's no longer just about the hardware. It actually is, as much as anything, is also about the software.
Wonderful. Thank you for talking to us.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to all of the scientists who took time out to speak with us for this episode. Sciencetown is produced by Mark Bowes, Alex Aries, and Ryan Yang. I'm Nicholas DeMille with co-host Ben Stevens. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, also known as KAUST. You can find us on all major social channels, wherever you get your podcasts, and at sciencetown.kaust.edu.sa.